And what we're sharing today and what we've been sharing in the last weeks, one thing I wanted to share with you is that please try and go over what we've talked about. Spend some time just looking at your notes, re-looking at the recording, and really just churning it in your mind. The other day in our monastery here, which hopefully all of you will come to on the retreat, we have quite a few new cows, new calves who have just been born, and they're really, really cute, and you can come and see them. But the cows are amazing because when you watch them through the day, they're just kind of sitting in one place, and the only part of their body that's moving is their mouth, because they're just like chewing grass like all day. I think like these guys have a good life. They just chew grass. They just look very chilled out. But I was thinking all of that chewing ultimately transforms into milk, which is like the miracle food that gives nourishment to the whole of civilization. And so I was thinking also that we also really need to chew on this wisdom. On the chat, tell me if you know the number of times you should chew something before swallowing it in order to get the full digestion. Let's see if anyone has ever thought about this. CJ says 30. Sujata says 32, is it? And Sujata says 22. 32, 26. Wow, you guys, you're all health experts. I know there's some holistic people and nutritionists on the call. Yeah, they say generally you should chew something between 30 and 35 times and then you get the full benefit of it. If you're eating like mashed potatoes, maybe like 10 or 15 is all right. And if it's nuts or something more, hard like that, it needs to be about 40, 45. But it's interesting, you just need to chew. And so it's a really important thing that we just need to also sometimes not get more and more information, but just really deeply think about the information that we've ingested and then try to digest it. So please, please do look at your notes. And thank you for all your comments. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Okay, so I'm going to bring up my slides and we're going to launch into another session, and we'll begin as we always do with our prayer of gratitude. Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I offer respect unto my spiritual teachers who have opened my eyes, which were blinded by the darkness of ignorance, with the torchlight of knowledge. We proceed on our fourth session. We've been taking everyone on a journey. We had a little introduction session, and then in our first major session, we talked about the inner Arjun, how Arjun is not just a character in history, but a metaphor of the confusion and inquisitiveness that sits within each one of us. Then last week, we took you on a whirlwind tour of the Bhagavad Gita and showed you some of the amazing things that Krishna shares and how he teaches us to rethink life by looking at many, many different aspects of wisdom and insight. Today, we'll be looking at Yogapedia. What is yoga? What is the purpose of yoga? What is the most effective means of yoga? And why yoga is so universal and perhaps one of the most important things that people need to know about in life. And then next week, we're going to end up talking about how all of this can create a beautiful world, create a beautiful life, can create a beautiful change in everything and everyone around us if we're able to share it in a beautiful and dynamic way. So yeah, I'm really, really excited. Today we're going to be talking about yoga. And as we begin, I just want to ask all of you, when I say yoga, can you just tell me in one word on the chat, what's the first thing that comes into your mind when I say the word yoga? What kind of images are conjured up in your mind? Paridhi says union, connection. Deborah says posture, silence. Yeah, for sure. Love. Beautiful. Justine says meditation. Himanshu says flexibility. Yeah. Tranquility. Calming the mind. Adriel, thank you. Andrea says Krishna. Wonderful. Transcendence. That's a beautiful word. Peace. Yeah. Yoga has so many different connotations. Did you know yoga is a $80 billion industry now every single day? Most people, when dealing with yoga or interfacing with yoga, use it for bodily and mental well-being. Many people use it for harmonizing different aspects of their life. Many people use it for a sense of finding equilibrium. Many people use it for spiritual purposes, oneness and harmony. So we're going to kind of look at, what is yoga and what is it meant to be? Where does yoga come from? And as I said, why is yoga so important to each one of us in our lives today? Before we do that, what I want to do, however, is I want to ask you a question. Some years ago, they did a survey in the world and they asked everyone a very, very simple, but a very, very insightful question. They asked people in the world, what do you do to relax? And I'm just going to ask all of you on the call, what do you think people do today to relax? It's a very stressful world. It's a very busy world. It's a world in which there are so many different demands. What do people do to relax? Trisho says read, Shito says dance. I just want all of you to look at some of these answers because they're very, very revealing. And it might also give you some ideas if you want to relax as well. Swati says listen to music. Emily likes to sleep. I don't know if she's going to get much sleep. She's in Radhadesh at the moment. Namrata likes holidays. Noah says chanting. Nice. Go out with family. Saroj likes painting. Paro, I won't say likes intoxication, but maybe she's just saying what people do. Thank you so much. A good podcast. Yeah, nice. All of you, you're kind of sharing with us some of the most popular ways to relax. These were the four top answers. And it's very, very revealing. The top ways in which people relax in the world today is they go on holiday. We all do that. Watching a TV show or a movie. Taking some form of intoxication or consciousness altering stimulant or substance or whatever it may be, and sleep. They're very interesting. You know, these surveys are very interesting because they're not just telling us about human behavior, but what they're also showing us or teaching us is something deeper about human psychology, about human mindset. And also, if we look even deeper, they're telling us also many, many, and showing us many, many spiritual lessons. And so if we were to say there's one thing common between every single one of these activities, which are the top four ways in which people relax in the world, then you don't need me to tell you that all of them are a form of escapism. Is it not? when we go on holiday, we escape our normal life. When we watch a TV show or watch a movie, then it's almost in some sense, we disconnect from reality. When we take intoxication, we take our consciousness into a different space. And when we sleep, essentially we're switching off from the world, from everyone and everything around us. The most amazing thing here is that these things teach us very deep truths about reality, which is that what everyone's basically trying to do to relax is they're basically trying to escape their life. They're trying to disconnect. They're trying to perhaps find another space, another situation, another space of consciousness in which they can reside. But unfortunately, when you go on holiday, you have to come back. When you watch a TV or a movie, it ends. When you take intoxication, eventually it subsides in its effect. And when you sleep, at one point, you have to ultimately wake up again. So none of these are a permanent form of escape, though they do indicate to us that each one of us have an innate tendency within us to try to want to disconnect from the world. I'm going to share with you a beautiful quote by C.S. Lewis. He was a Christian theologian, very accomplished, many interesting writings. And in one of his writings, he says, "If I find within myself desires which no experience of this world can fulfill, I must conclude I was made for another world." The fact that we are all innately trying to disconnect from life, disconnect from the world, that is very, very revealing, because it shows to us that there's something unnatural, there's something unfamiliar, there's something unfulfilling about life and this world. Even when we have everything, even when we've achieved everything, we still do these things, showing us that somehow that situation that we've created hasn't fully satisfied and brought us deep contentment. Therefore, C.S. Lewis says, maybe that's a strong indication that we're meant for another world, that we're constantly trying to move away from this world. And that's basically what yoga is. Yoga is, according to the teachers of the East, the ultimate universal aspiration of every single living being, every single soul, because yoga literally means union. It's the means by which we disconnect from the unfamiliar, the unnatural, the unsatisfying, and we reconnect with our original nature, our original relationships, our original states of being and places of sacred space and residence. Yoga is the process by which we again find connection with our original identity and our original purpose. Here, what I'm sharing with you today, I'm going really to the root of yoga. But when we talk about yoga in the world today, most people don't really see yoga for this purpose, or they have some notion that yoga is for something more than just the body and the mind, but they're not quite sure what that is. And so what I'm going to try to do today is give you a deeper sense of what yoga is. And share with you what is the most powerful types of yoga that we can practice. Now, this is a chart which shows you the full broad horizon of Vedic scripture. And these scriptures and all of these books that you see on the screen, they contain knowledge, not just of transcendence or knowledge of a spiritual nature, but they contain knowledge of many, many aspects of how to live in the world, in the here and now, in the most harmonious way. I think I showed you this before, but for example, here you have Ayurveda as part of the Upavedas, which teach you about medicinal art. Here you have, for example, Jyotish, which is all about astrology and how to understand different influences in your life at a particular time. Here you have Kalpa, which is different rituals and different kind of ceremonies you can do at different junctures in your life to create auspiciousness. So you have many, many amazing things here. However, the goal of all of this literature is ultimately yoga. And if you look here, this is the itihas. Now, the itihas is an interesting word. Iti means thus, has means happened. So itihas literally means thus it happened. And itihas are literally histories. And there are two major histories in the Vedic literature. One of them is the Ramayana, which many of you have heard of, the tales and accounts of Lord Ram. And the other major history is known as the Mahabharata, which we've been discussing because the Bhagavad Gita is found within the Mahabharata. So within these histories, you have the Mahabharata, and within the Mahabharata, the culmination is the Bhagavad Gita, which we're studying. And the Bhagavad Gita is said to be the most comprehensive work on yoga. Therefore, the Bhagavad Gita is said to be the essence of all of this knowledge, because it reveals yoga in its most clear and concise and culmination of yoga in the most powerful way. However, if you see here, there is also another major work which talks about yoga, and that's known as Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And much of what we know in the world, or what most people in the world know about yoga today, they take from the Yoga Sutras. However, the Yoga Sutras are focusing on one particular aspect of yoga, and therefore the Yoga Sutras in and of themselves, if you read it, may not give you the highest conclusion of yoga. And people tend to take parts of the Yoga Sutra and conclude that is what yoga is. And so when we want to learn about yoga, most people, what they know of yoga is the Yoga Sutras, as I mentioned. The Yoga Sutras, the scope of this work deals with one type of yoga called Ashtanga Yoga. Ashta means eight and Anga means limbs. So it literally means the limbs, the eight-limbed yoga process. And the Yoga Sutras describes those eight steps. And the other major work on yoga is the Bhagavad Gita. And the scope of the Bhagavad Gita is the entire yoga analysis. And it describes all the three main yogas, including what Patanjali is basically explaining in detail in the Yoga Sutra. Why am I telling you this? Because 99% of people in the world, their conception of yoga is coming from the Yoga Sutras. And perhaps 1% of people in the world, their conception of yoga is coming from the Bhagavad Gita. The irony is that the most comprehensive and complete understanding of yoga is actually given in the Bhagavad Gita, because Krishna looks at all the different yoga processes. He then concludes what is the culmination of those yoga processes, and then he outlines how to actually practice it in one's daily life. Whereas in the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali is focusing on one yoga practice and is outlining the eight steps, and what most people know are only two of those steps, which I'll explain in a minute. That's why yoga has almost lost its original, authentic, deep meaning in the world today, because what people know of yoga is two steps, part of two steps of an eight-step process, which is just one yoga practice among many, instead of going to the actual source of, you know, yoga, the ultimate yoga treatise, which is the Bhagavad Gita. So I'm going to share with you the yoga conception from both of these literatures. Let's start with Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. So Patanjali's Yoga Sutras deal with Ashtanga Yoga. And therefore, when I asked you at the beginning of the session today what you think of when you hear the word yoga, many of you said postures, many of you said breathing, relaxation, mindfulness, reducing stress. This is basically taken from Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. The 8 steps of yoga that Patanjali offers begins with yama, abstaining from certain things. Then he explains there are niyama, certain things that you should do. In other words, these 2 things are all about lifestyle. Then he explains there are asanas, there are certain postures that you should do. And then he explains there are certain breathing exercises which are helping one to control the mind. Once that is done, he explains that one has to begin withdrawing their consciousness from material entanglement, material concern. Then one has to positively concentrate on the spiritual reality. An intensified form of that concentration is known as dhyan. For example, Zen Buddhism comes from the word dhyan. And the culmination is samadhi, or absorption in the spiritual reality. Now, what most people know about yoga today is basically this. 2 steps of the 8 steps of Ashtanga Yoga. They know about asanas and they know about pranayama. But this is not a complete understanding of yoga. You're just understanding 2 steps of 8 steps of one practice of yoga, one line of yoga. Asanas and pranayama is powerful. For example, asanas, they do different things. For example, when you have standing asanas or postures, then that basically helps your respiration, reproductive systems. When you do inverted asanas, you know, like you can see some of the inverted postures here, that helps your metabolism. It's said that twisting postures help your digestion. It's said that bending postures help your circulation. And the overall idea of doing all of these bodily postures is that basically what they create is clarity, vitality, and they create mental stability, and ultimately a sense of purity. So they prepare the ground for higher spiritual consciousness. And pranayama is said that breathing is very much connected to the mind. Breathing is very much connected to the emotions. Breathing is very much connected to the state of consciousness. When we're angry, our breathing changes. When we're excited, our breathing changes. When we're sad, our breathing changes. So breathing is very much connected to the subtle aspects of our being. And therefore, pranayama is about controlling our breathing so that we can have more stability, more mental serenity, and more control over our emotions. So basically, what you see in the world of yoga and what people understand of yoga is basically steps 3 and 4 of Ashtanga Yoga. However, because those 2 steps have been taken out and divorced from the bigger schema of yoga, what we can almost say is that yoga has pretty much lost its soul in the world today. Yoga is actually less about relaxing your body and more about awakening your spirituality. Yoga is less about looking good on the outside and more about experiencing divinity on the inside. Yoga is not just about connecting your head to your toes, but it's more about connecting the soul to the supreme. Yoga is not about flipping your body upside down, although you can do it because it does help your circulation, but it's more about attaining an internal equipoise when there are ups and downs and difficulties and unexpected occurrences of life. People think yoga is there to help you overcome material diseases. It can do that, but it's more about cleansing material desires. It's more about reconfiguring what we deem as important in this world. Some people think yoga helps you to enjoy the world more, but actually, yoga is meant to help you to serve the world more. This is a message we really want to give to the world, because otherwise people are practicing yoga, but they're just focusing on the byproducts of yoga and they're missing the essence of yoga. If you really want to get the best fruit, the best result, the best output of yoga, then it's incredibly important to focus on this. And therefore, today, what we're sharing with you is not that Yoga Sutras of Patanjali are wrong or they're not useful. They are useful. But what we're going to share with you is that there's a bigger tradition of yoga, a bigger analysis of yoga given by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, which helps you to frame and contextualize what yoga is really meant for. So now we've looked at Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Now let's go into Bhagavad Gita and see what does Krishna say about yoga. In the first week, I showed you this diagram that in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is basically talking about five main topics. Krishna begins by talking about who we are. Remember, rediscovering identity. We're not the body, we're not the mind, we're not the designations that we've attached to ourselves, and we're not even the impurities or the different character traits that we've picked up over time, but rather we're a spiritual being beyond all of these things. We're spiritual beings on a human journey. And where's that human journey taking place? It's taking place in the world. Remember last week I talked about reconfiguring energy. So this world has three basic modes of energy. And therefore Krishna explains the whole landscape of how the soul is living in this world. And when the soul lives in this world, it's always active. So it's always performing different activities. And for each one of those activities, there are concomitant reactions. And that's the science of karma. Overseeing this whole system is Ishvara, or the Supreme Lord. And that Ishvara has a relationship with the soul and the world. Ishvara controls the world through the agency of time. If you remember, we talked about how time in the Vedic literature is cyclical. And so it's always going through different cycles. And the relationship between the Ishvara and the soul, or the Supreme Brahman and the individual Brahman, is what we call yoga. And all of the five aspects are ultimately culminating in achieving yoga. Because remember what C.S. Lewis said, if I find within myself desires which no experience of this world can fulfill, I must conclude I was made for another world. So the constant theme that Krishna is giving through the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is giving us indications of how to live this life, how to navigate this world, how to deal with the various ups and downs that we'll no doubt encounter on our journey. But the constant theme running through the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna is actually saying, you're meant for another world. You're meant for another type of connection. You're meant for something higher. And therefore, actually, when you look at the Bhagavad Gita, every single chapter is actually called a yoga. So there's 18 chapters in the Bhagavad Gita, and every single one of the chapters is actually a different yoga. So our teachers, they show us these names for the individual chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. So for example, these are the first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. And what they actually do is they're giving us a different perspective of yoga. The yoga of dejection. That's it. That's amazing. Have you ever thought of that? You know, we've heard of hot yoga. You've heard of Beer yoga, you've heard of laughing yoga, you've heard of so many types of yoga. Have you ever heard of the yoga of dejection? It's amazing because Krishna says even dejection, even depression, even distress is a yoga. Because in that dejection, if it causes you to question, if it causes you to inquire, if it causes you to search for connection, then that dejection becomes a yoga because it's a factor which is opening the doors to divine revelation. So Krishna is incredible. The first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is the yoga of dejection. And then there's analysis, action, knowledge, renunciation, meditation. So every single chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is a yoga. And broadly speaking, Krishna's analysis of yoga is divided into three. So what's explained is that the first six chapters all ultimately summarize karma yoga. And I'm going to explain this more in a second. The second six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita are also very, very interesting. Krishna kind of shifts his discussion with Arjun from simply talking about the material world and how to function in the here and now. And Krishna goes into higher topics of how to establish loving connection. And therefore, the second six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita are known as Bhakti Yoga. And then the final six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna kind of brings it back. So he kind of starts in the world by talking about karma yoga and how to live here and how to act in a divine way. Then Krishna goes into bhakti, in which he kind of talks a lot about transcendence. And then what Krishna does in the final six chapters is he comes back to the world and he gives further knowledge on how to navigate the different things that we experience in this world. And therefore, the final six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita are known as Jnana Yoga chapters. So broadly speaking, we can say these are the three types of yoga which are contained within the whole spectrum of Vedic knowledge. You may say, where's Ashtanga Yoga? Because Patanjali's got a whole book on that and you talked about Ashtanga Yoga. So if you look here, chapter number six, Dhyana Yoga is basically Krishna's summary of Ashtanga Yoga. So Ashtanga Yoga is also covered within the Karma Yoga chapters. So now, every single yoga that you see in the world today that's authentic comes under one of these three categories, or four categories, you can say. It's either Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, or Ashtanga Yoga. And there may be different names. For example, some people talk about Raja Yoga. So Raja Yoga is another name or another expression of Ashtanga Yoga. Or sometimes people talk about, for example, Kirtan Yoga or Mantra Yoga. So Kirtan Yoga or Mantra Yoga is basically part of Bhakti Yoga. Or sometimes here, Dhyana Yoga, people talk about. So that's part of Ashtanga Yoga. Or sometimes Hatha Yoga, people talk about. That's part of Ashtanga Yoga. So every single yoga has to come under these categories. And then what Krishna goes on to explain is that these yogas are actually building on each other. One great teacher, his name is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. What he actually says is that the Bhagavad Gita is like a jewel box. The base of the jewel box is all about karma yoga. The cover of the jewel box is all about jnana yoga, or the wisdom of how to navigate this world. But the actual jewel within the box is bhakti yoga, or love. Because karma yoga basically deals with our active life. each of us have to act in this world. We have to function. We have responsibilities. We have duties. So karma yoga helps us to understand how to navigate this world and connect to everything in the divine quest. Jnana yoga is dealing with our intellectual life. Because we have questions, we have doubts, we want to understand how to live in this world, we want to have insight, we want to have knowledge. And therefore, Jnana yoga helps to satisfy the intellect. However, beyond our active life and intellectual life, what we really seek is emotional life or love. Even if we are successful, even if we have all the knowledge, unless we have love, it won't really satisfy our heart at the core. And therefore, Krishna explains that the ultimate culmination of all yoga practice is to awaken divine love. Karma yoga and jnana yoga can be used as a stepping stones or as assistants. But ultimately, the ultimate type of yoga is to connect with the divine through love. And so now you're getting a better picture of yoga. What I've first explained to you is that yoga has a higher purpose, which is connection. That's where we begun. And then what I try to share with you is that there are three or four, we can say we're showing three here, and we can add in Ashtanga yoga. There are basically those four main strands of yoga. And then what we're sharing with you is that those four strands of yoga ultimately culminate in bhakti yoga, which is love. And in that sense, the Bhagavad Gita is not just sharing with us different types of yoga process, but it's taking us on a yoga ladder. What karma yoga does is it teaches us detachment. We have to work in this world. We have to have relationships. We have to function. But how do you do that in such a way that you don't get drawn in, you don't get bogged down, you don't get covered by all of that responsibility and chaos and duties that we have in the world today? And so in chapters number 1 to 5, Krishna is gifting Arjuna with this understanding that when you learn karma yoga or how to act in this world and connect everything in a spiritual way, then what happens is those activities don't bind you and you develop an inner detachment so that you're living in this world, but you're not being influenced by the world. But then Krishna says, through jnana yoga, we add to that detachment, and what we give you is further knowledge. Knowledge of the soul, knowledge of the supreme Brahman, knowledge of different aspects of how the universe operates. And so in chapters number 13 to 18, Krishna gives this higher aspect of yoga, which is now how to intellectually, not just through your acts, but intellectually how to study knowledge and become immersed intellectually in the spiritual reality. Krishna also gives Ashtanga yoga, which builds on knowledge and detachment, but also gives a sense of how to meditate. Because remember, Ashtanga yoga takes us, after asanas and pranayama, it takes us into dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. So not just the intellectual absorption, but an internal absorption in divinity, meditation, a closer connection with the divine. And this is described in chapter number 6. And then bhakti works on all of those, but it gives you one extra thing, which is ultimately how to awaken love. And this is described in chapters number 7 to 12. And so You can see here that there is a ladder, there is a progression, that every yoga is good, every yoga is beneficial, every yoga gives its own gifts, but every yoga is ultimately culminating in achieving this love, because this love and this connection of love is what we seek at our core. Now, when talking about love, then the natural question comes, who are we trying to love? What are we trying to love? Who is that divinity? What is the nature of that divinity? And so Krishna explains that as you go up the yoga processes, then you not only get different gifts which help you to connect with divinity, but you are able to understand divinity in a deeper and deeper and more intimate way. So what is explained is that when one is in Jnana Yoga, then they are connecting with divinity, but more as an impersonal energy. And in Sanskrit, this is known as Brahman. When one performs Astanga Yoga, their relationship with divinity grows, not just to understanding that divinity is an impersonal energy, but that divinity is also an inner guide. In other words, divinity is within us. And that is known as Param Atma, or the super soul. But later on, what Krishna describes is that divinity is ultimately a supreme person known as Bhagavan. And that supreme person is a person that we can have a relationship with, an exchange with, a reciprocation with. And so can you see, I hope it's a little technical, but I'm trying to share with you how yoga is ultimately about connection. There are different types of yoga. And what every yoga is doing is two things. Number one, giving you a different gift, which helps you to connect with divinity. And number two, what every yoga system is doing is revealing who that divinity is in a more and more personal way. Now, one may question, do I have to then go through all of these yoga processes one by one? Is it that we start here and then we go to Jnana Yoga and then we practice Astanga and then finally we get to Bhakti Yoga? Do we have to do that? Some people may do that, but Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, and the great teachers explain, that if you can embrace Bhakti Yoga from day one, then you actually achieve the fruits of all the other yoga processes automatically, because Bhakti Yoga is considered the perfection of yoga. Because in Bhakti Yoga, work is incorporated, detachment is incorporated, there's knowledge because there's study of literature, there is meditation on the divine, and there's also a reciprocation of love. And so it's said that by practicing Bhakti Yoga, one achieves the fruit and the culmination of all yoga practices. Then one may say, why have all the other yoga processes then? Why not just stick with Bhakti Yoga and just have one thing? Because everyone in the beginning is not looking for love. Each of us in this world have different desires. Each of us in this world have a different agenda. Each of us come to spiritual life for different things. And so what Krishna does is he creates different yoga processes which help you to fulfill different desires. Some people just want to know. Some people just want to be successful in the world. Some people want to, you know, steady the mind and achieve more vitality on the mental and physical level. So what Krishna does is he creates yoga processes which can help you to achieve those things. But inbuilt in those yoga processes are a doorway to go higher. And so many people will go through these yoga processes step by step, like a ladder. And many will just take up bhakti yoga and realize, looking at their life, that ultimately I'm looking for love. And if I practice bhakti yoga, then I'll be able to achieve all of those things. So, in conclusion today, why is yoga so important? Because yoga is the most universal quest that everyone's on, because yoga means connection. And connection to what? Connection to the divine, the supreme reality, the supreme soul. When we achieve this connection with the divine, then, and we do it in its most powerful way, an intimate way, then we, which is bhakti yoga, we develop love. And love is what everyone seeks. Just look at all the songs. Just look at all the songs in the chart. They're all about love. But most of them are about frustrated love, because we can't seem to find love in the world. It seems to always frustrate us. Because love can be on different levels. They can, I explained this last week. There's physical love, or so-called physical love. There's so-called emotional love. But then there is spiritual or divine love. And what determines whether something is physical, emotional, or spiritual love? It depends on our vision. It depends on the role. And it depends on the goal. And now I'll explain to you what I mean by this. When we're connected with the divine in love through the practice of bhakti yoga, I was explaining to you that bhakti yoga is like the jewel inside the jewel box, like a diamond. So what happens is when we awaken this love of bhakti yoga, it's like when you put a laser beam inside a diamond, and that laser beam, because it's been directed within the diamond, that light goes everywhere in all directions. So the idea of bhakti yoga is when you develop love for the divine, connection with the supreme person, then what happens is your love for everyone and everything will automatically arise and expand and become fulfilling. All your relationships will flourish. And why will your relationships flourish? Because you'll now be relating to people not on the level of physical love or emotional love, but on the level of spiritual love. And how will you know that you have a relationship of spiritual love? Because your vision of that person has changed. The role that you see you play in their life has changed. And the goal of your relationship has changed. Now, let me give you an example. One relationship could be husband and wife. Another relationship could be parent and child. Another relationship could be friend and friend. So when these relationships are spiritual relationships, then the vision, role, and goal is a divine vision, role, and goal. So let me give you an example. How do you know as a parent you have spiritual love for your child? Because firstly, your vision. How do you see your child? Do you just see your child as your son or your daughter, a material body? Or do you see that this child is a soul that's going on their own journey, that somehow or other has entered this chapter of existence, and that you're their caretaker, and that, you know, you are being brought together by divinity because you have something to do with each other and serve each other in order to achieve your spiritual goal and aspiration. When you begin to see your child like that, that this isn't just my son or daughter, this is a soul who's on a journey through this world, and somehow we've been brought together for a higher purpose, your vision now has changed of your child. When your vision of your child changes, then what happens? The role that you play in their life also changes. So when you see that my role now for my child is not just to help them be successful in this world, not just to make sure that they do everything that any successful person does in this world, but I have to serve them. I have to encourage them. I have to empower them to also awaken their spirituality. Then it's now developing into spiritual love. And thirdly, the goal. When you see that this child is there, what's the goal of this relationship? The goal is that together we are going to serve everyone around us. We're going to serve the world. We're going to serve God. The goal of our relationship is to serve God and serve humanity and serve our family members. That's the goal of our relationship. Then the parent-child relationship is not now just on the level of physical love or emotional love, but it's now on the level of spiritual love. And you can take the same framework and look at husband and wife relationships or relationships between friends. Ask yourself, how much of your vision is spiritual of that person? How much of a spiritual role do you see you play in that person's life? And how much of the goal of your relationship is to make a spiritual contribution? When you have that vision, then all your relationships are spiritualized. And you can only have this vision, role, and goal in your relationships if you've developed your love for the supreme divinity. And that love is ultimately achieved through the practice of yoga. And that's why yoga is so important. Because yoga helps us to connect with the divine, which then helps us to connect with everyone and everything in this world in its most perfect and pure way. And when we do that, life becomes incredible. And that is what Krishna is teaching ultimately in the Bhagavad Gita. So yoga is much more than what people have understood often in this world. And it's an incredibly deep concept which can transform our life on all levels. So it's something which is worth studying very, very deeply and closely. So thank you so much. I hope it was a little more technical session, and you may need to kind of watch it again, and perhaps you have some questions. So we'll ask Raj to also come up and see whether any questions have come up. But I hope this has been useful to give you a bit more of a wider understanding about yoga and the part it plays in our lives. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Keshav Swami. Absolutely amazing class. And yeah, really, really insightful. I'm just like trying to process everything you said. And it was just so good. Especially at the end when you talked about how we can vision, the vision we should have for relationships was really powerful. And then doesn't just apply to like a child. It can also apply to your spouse or to your kids, or I guess it extends to every relationship that you have and spiritualizing that relationship. But you can't spiritualize that relationship until you have that relationship with the divine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like I think I mentioned that yesterday, that when you water the root of the tree, then all the leaves and the branches and the twigs automatically become satisfied. So it's like, that's why yoga is so important, because if you connect with the divine, the root, then everything and every other relationship in your life automatically is nourished. And it just becomes beautiful. Whereas if you try to water every single, or, you know, kind of spray every single leaf, then you'd kind of be there all day and you'd find leaves drying out. And sometimes we feel like that, like, I've got all these relationships, all these things, how do I satisfy it all? But when you go to the root and start there, then you actually become empowered and enlightened as to how to connect with everyone and everything in a much deeper way. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you to, I'm getting some great questions in. I have a lot of questions. And I think it just shows how amazing the session has been. So, okay. So you mentioned about watering the root, I guess that root comes from the connection with the divine, which you described as bhakti yoga. So Pinky has asked, in terms of these steps that you mentioned, can someone skip some steps and go straight to bhakti yoga, or do they have to go from, like, you know, karma yoga to bhakti yoga and like that? So how does that work?
Yeah, bhakti yoga in the way that, you know, we are practicing it today, incorporates all other yogas. So, for example, karma yoga is incorporated because bhakti yogis don't eject themselves from the world, but they learn how to make their work into service to humanity. They learn how to transform their family duties so that it becomes service to God. They learn how to basically connect everything, all their karma or their responsibilities of life, in love and service. So karma yoga is incorporated in bhakti. Jnana yoga, the intellectual aspect, is incorporated in bhakti because we have bhakti scriptures. And in those bhakti scriptures, all of the insights of, you know, these five topics are given in a very deep way, along with the very devotional aspect. And so the jnana yoga is satisfied. Meditation and fixing the mind on the Supreme is also connected, because in bhakti, we have different practices like mantra meditation and different processes. You know, we have deities by which we focus the mind on divinity. And at the same time, then the added elements of bhakti, which awaken the love. So, yeah, in essence, in this day and age, it's not that we can't learn from karma yoga, jnana yoga, and astanga and benefit. Like, many bhakti yogis will still do asanas, and many bhakti yogis will still use elements of karma yoga in order to live a spiritual life. But their focus is still bhakti yoga, because that almost encompasses everything.
Great, thank you so much. And that's very practical, I think. And it really helps people with, I guess, their day-to-day life. Is there any tips for people? Because a couple of similar questions that have come in from Shreya. And also we had another question from Kamal, and both of us, can you give practical tips of how you can practice bhakti yoga with being at home, having a family life? Because it seems like both seem quite hard to balance. So both of them have asked similar questions, Shreya and Kamala. How do you?
So basically, what they're asking is, how do we incorporate bhakti into our kind of daily functioning? Is that
exactly? Yeah,
basically that. Okay, so what I'm going to do, I'm just going to bring up one slide, and maybe this will help to kind of clarify it. And maybe what I'll try to do is I'll also try to share this slide with you after the session. Let's see if it's going to open. Just give me one second. I just think this is going to kind of explain it in a much more succinct way.
Okay, so let me just share my screen. So if you can see this, if you want to know how to practice bhakti yoga basically in your daily life, then there's bhakti yoga in terms of the karma yoga aspect, in terms of every day you work, you have your family life, you have your social circle, you have your daily tasks. So what you try to do is you try to incorporate devotion and spiritual objectives within each one of these things. So you dedicate, you learn to connect your work to the divine. You connect to create a family life in which the divine, there's remembrance of the divine and there's spiritual practices. Your social circle, you try to create in such a way that it's inspiring your spiritual journey. And your daily tasks, you know, like eating or, you know, driving your car, what you listen to while you're driving in your car, all of that can be tailored so that it's helping you in your divine journey. So the first thing you can do in bhakti yoga is look at your routine life and factor bhakti in. And then the second thing you can do in bhakti yoga is outside of your routine life, everyone has some free time, extra time. So in that time, you can do focused bhakti activities. So one of them is chanting, mantra meditation. Another one is like worshiping, if you like deities or forms of divinity. You can read bhakti scriptures. You can do practical activities of service. You know, you can come to a temple and like wash the floor or cook in the one of the kitchens or and associating with other bhakti yogis. So if you do this, then you create a bhakti life, basically. And that's how you practice bhakti yoga.
Wow, that's so amazing. And it's very practical, like practical tips that we can actually implement. And I'll be sharing that slide out because I think that's fantastic. There's a lot of questions coming in about how do we actually apply it in our day to day. We've got, I would say, two similar questions come in, if we're okay for time.
Yeah, sure.
The first one we've got is, I guess I'll group these together. Sonal Gawande. And then we've got the same question, a similar question also from Kamal. And both of our, sorry, not Kamal, Harsha. Harsha and Sonal have asked, how can we love and have detachment in the same place? Or how do we practice detachment?
Yeah. So there is a difference between affection and attachment. So it's not that when you become a bhakti yogi and when you're detached from the world that you're not allowed to have any kind of relationships of love with anyone. You're supposed to be like detached from everyone and everything. That's not quite what we're saying. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring up something on screen which will help you to understand this. Can you see this infographic?
Yeah.
Okay. There is a difference between being attentive and loving in relationships, being affectionate and being attached. And this is the difference. When you're attached to someone, then the basis of that relationship are your emotions and your sentiments, how you feel about someone, you know, just all based on your own mind. But when you're affectionate and attentive in a spiritual way in a relationship, your interaction with them is based on spiritual intelligence. That doesn't mean there's no emotions in it, but it means that your vision of them, your understanding of the relationship is all underpinned by a deeper spiritual understanding.
When that deeper spiritual understanding is not there in a relationship, then the emotions tend to become very, very material. But when there's a spiritual foundation, it means you can have emotions, but those emotions won't carry you away. For example, Arjun, I've given this example before. Arjun heard the whole Bhagavad Gita, understood his spiritual identity, and understood his son was also a spirit soul. But when his son died, he cried. He lamented. He was distressed. He grieved. Now, there's emotion, naturally. That it's not that because Arjun heard the Bhagavad Gita, he's completely detached. He had no emotions anymore. So he cried for his son, Abhimanyu. But because the underlying vision of his son was that, no, he's a soul on a journey. After grieving and having his emotions, he picked up his bow and he started fighting. He got on with life again. So when we have spiritual vision behind our relationships, then we can be affectionate without being detached. And there's other things, but I'll just stop there because otherwise it will go into a long... But that's the basic point, that when you're a bhakti yogi, it's full of emotion, it's full of spiritual emotion, but it's spiritual emotion. In other words, you see your children, your husband, your wife, your friends, you want to serve them, you want to love them. But behind all of it is your vision that they are spirit souls. They're on their journey. And my real affection is shown to them by serving them and by assisting them to be the best they can in their journey. And in that way, you can be loving, you can be affectionate, you can be kind without being attached. Is that okay?
Brilliant. Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much. And seems like there is a amazing diagrams that you have. So we've got so much to get from you. And that's a really great way, I think, to put it. And okay, I'm going to go to our next question because we've had this question about three times from different people. So they've... So I've had three similar questions, one from Ipsy, one from Alpesh, and one from Ananda Vilas. So all of them have essentially asked, when people are meditating, what are they meditating on? And the idea of, you know, yoga teaches normally impersonalism. So you're meditating on a light, or you're meditating on something that's not personal or not a form. And does connecting to the divine mean you're an energy, or connecting to an energy, or what should we meditate on, or what does that mean? Like, so all three have asked basically that question in essence, like, yeah, what are we meditating on? What are they meditating on? What does it mean to meditate on the impersonal aspect?
Okay, so if you remember, I mentioned there were three aspects of the divine: the impersonal energy, known as Brahman, the inner guide, known as Paramatma, and the supreme person, known as Bhagavan. These are basically the three aspects of divinity, because perennially there has been a debate, like, is God a light? Is it an energy? Is he a person? Who is God? And basically the Vedas say God is all three, of those. He's an energy, he's an inner guide, and he's also a supreme person that you can have a relationship with. Sometimes we give the analogy of a train. Three people were looking, trying to understand what's a train. They all three saw in the distance smoke and light and sound. And one of them said, I know what a train is, smoke, light, and sound, and they left. The other two waited longer. They saw the train come into the station. So they said, oh, we know what a train is. It's smoke, light, and sound, and there's carriages. And the second person left. And then the final one stayed longer, and he saw the people coming out. And he saw, I know what a train is. It's smoke, light, sound. It has carriages, and it's got people, taking people from one place to another.
in one sense, they were all right. But the third person had the most detailed understanding. And so Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan are different phases of understanding the Absolute. And by understanding Bhagavan or the Supreme Person, one understands all other aspects of divinity. Now, when we talk about meditation, generally impersonalists are not really meditating on any kind of form, or they're not visualizing anything. Rather, their practice is one of emptying material desires and almost becoming a non-entity in the world, annihilating their identity. And therefore, you don't find so much of an emphasis on meditation, or even if there is, it's ultimately with a view to giving up meditation, because the idea is to empty out everything. Whereas the Astanga yogi is meditating, but meditating on divinity within. And the bhakti yogi, what they're doing is they're meditating on a supreme person outside of themselves, who is also within, but is also ultimately outside of themselves, and someone that they can have a relationship with, someone they can serve, someone they can interact with. And you know, so that is all revealed in the Vedic scriptures. So there are different types of meditation depending on the goal of the spiritual practitioner. So impersonalists generally are not meditating on anything. They're trying to clear their mind out. The Astanga yogi is meditating on the divinity within, but that divinity within is more of a passive relationship. It's not as is a sense of divinity's with me. I'm being protected. I'm being guided. I'm being sheltered. But there's not much of an exchange. But the bhakti yogi's meditation is on divinity outside of them, the personal aspect, who they can have an exchange of love with, because higher love is expressed in service. So yeah, I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's amazing. So we have three aspects, but each one has a level of understanding, a level of realization, and it depends what we're trying to achieve. And if we want a personal relationship, then we try to meditate on something personal, because relationships are personal essentially. Okay, I've got one last question. And Valentina has asked this, and I think it's a really nice question to maybe end on. And I guess it comes from a personal view as well. So Valentina has asked, so her family are asking, well, she wants to know what to say to her family and her friends, because is it wrong to, I'll read the question out so it makes sense. Is it wrong to say that yoga is not a religion? Because for her, for me, it is very much related to Sanatan Dharma. Just asking because I have this conversation with my Catholic family and my fellow friends from the Abrahamic traditions who, for example, do want to do yoga, but they don't want to sit with her and say chant or connect with God, etc. So what should she do? Because the core message of love is in all traditions, but of course, yoga comes from the Vedic tradition. So what? Because obviously there's a disparity, because that's not really there in the Abrahamic traditions in that sense, doing yoga. But the message of love is, and God is. So what should she reply to them?
Beautiful question. Thank you so much. Okay, let me just bring something up here. You know, in the world today, we have like different words that we use. And sometimes it's just good to revisit those words and understand what they really mean. So one word is religion. Right? Another word is spirituality. And another word is yoga. Now, if you think about all of these, in their etymology, they're actually talking about exactly the same thing in their essence. Because religion comes from the Latin re-ligare. Re means again, ligare means to link or to connect. So basically, religion is that process by which you link again with the Supreme.
Spirituality, if you think about it, what does spirituality mean? It means to go beyond the material or to connect with the spiritual. And what does yoga mean? It comes from the Sanskrit word, it comes from the Sanskrit word yuj, or in English we say yoke, which means to connect or union. Union. Terrible handwriting. Can you basically see that in essence, whether we call it religion, spirituality, or yoga, it's all amounting to the same thing, which is connecting to who? The divine. And as a result, awakening love. But the problem is nowadays people have a certain notion of religion. They see it as rituals, as culture, as tradition. Nowadays people have a notion of spirituality, and people have a notion of what yoga is. And so sometimes people say, I don't like yoga, but I like religion, but I'm not spiritual, but I'm religious, or I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. When actually the essence of all of these things is exactly the same thing. And the most amazing thing is, even if someone's an atheist, then right at the beginning of the talk, I told you that even the atheist is trying to relax and disconnect from this world and trying to connect to something. So whether you're an atheist, whether you're a religionist, whether you're a spiritualist, whether you're a yogi, everyone in their own way is ultimately trying to connect. This is the universal human endeavor, because we're until we connect, we're like a fish out of water. You can give us whatever, but we won't be satisfied, right? So I think when we're speaking to people, we just need to be sensitive and understand what are their what connotations are they bringing to every word. So like I'll meet someone and I'll be like, no, I'm not religious. They're like, you're a monk. I'm like, no, I'm not religious, because I can see in your mind what you're thinking about religion is ritual, tradition, culture, sectarian, and I'm not none of that. So basically I'm not religious, because I'm responding to your perception of what religion is. So I think we just need to be tuned in and understand, like when people say, are you religious, or are you spiritual, or are you a yogi, or is yoga religion, is yoga spiritual? You just need to understand, how are people defining these words? Because ultimately all we're trying to do, each one of us, is find a complete fulfillment of the heart. And that can only be done if we reawaken love. And we can only reawaken love if we meet the divine, and the process of meeting the divine is through yoga. Sorry, I probably said that about 6 times during this talk, but I'm just kind of like, I basically said the same things like in 6 slightly different ways. So I hope it hasn't been too repetitive, but I'm just trying to get that point through, that yoga is actually super universal. It's like what everyone is looking for.
Amazing. Yeah, we're all looking for yoga, and that's such a amazing way of explaining it and putting it to us. And I think that's really helped a lot of people, including me. And yeah, and I guess it depends, you know, on that mind frame you were saying. And yeah, thank you so much. That's a beautiful explanation. And I think even though you said it 6 times, I think everyone's resonating with it really well. So I guess we can leave it there. This is like the longest we've gone on, just because of some amount of questions that have come in. I've had to group questions together, and still questions I haven't been able to ask. So yeah, maybe we can end there.
Yeah, and we look forward to inviting everyone. If you haven't signed up, please do. We've been, it's the Thingita retreat is going to be incredible. So yeah. I think Adriel's just put the link down there. So yeah, please do come along, bring your friends, even if they're not religious, even if they're not spiritual.
They're going to have a great time. It's going to be very relaxed, and we're all there. We're all friends, and it will be a beautiful time. So yeah, if you can come, please do. And have a good time in Radhadesh, Raj, singing your heart out.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm here on a retreat, so yes, it's something magical about retreats. And I was actually checking how many people have signed up, and there's only 30 spaces left. So I think you'll have to get in quick. Otherwise, we'll have to close the registration. So yeah, if you're planning on coming, please make sure you sign up. Otherwise, you can't come.
thank you everyone.
You're brilliant. Thank you so much, Keshav Swami, for a brilliant session, and we look forward to seeing everyone next week for the last session next week.
Thank you everyone, wishing you a wonderful evening. All the best.